part of the issue with the social media world is that you see something and it's visceral. It's in your disembodied mind. It's overwhelming your mind. And then there's the immediate desire to respond to it. And there's not this sort of social construct around saying, wait a minute, if I lash out, if I just react to this, that would look bad. As it would in the physical world, where if you're standing with a group of people and somebody's saying something controversial, you might not have the desire to immediately launch back with some sort of fiery counter argument. You might say, well, I'm just gonna, I don't agree with them, but I'm just gonna let it go. So it's like this, there's the social element, I think, of social media is actually almost a problem for democracy, because we have to be able to let our cool minds thrive. So not this sort of hot button response to something, but this more dispassionate, sort of more reason-based, more consensus-based. I mean, that's what we need, is some sort of general air of consensus that I think is starting to just crumble because of the way that the public is embracing social media.
Journalist Chris Zappone joins John and Scoop from Australia for this episode of the Plutopia podcast. We talk about media policing, shared freedom, regulation of Facebook, and identity politics. We also explore the wisdom of people wanting the freedom to say anything.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to another Plutopia podcast. Today, we're going to have a great talk, a very interesting talk with Chris Zappone, who works as a foreign news editor in Australian media. He's written about geopolitics, space, outer space, technology, ideology, and the future. He's also consulted with universities, think tanks, and businesses in the area of tech disruption, information war, which is right on, and cryptocurrencies. He also has an interest in history and utopia. And I guess, Chris, you also wanted us to note that you are speaking for yourself and not for any of the people you write for.
That's right.
Right on. Okay. So here we are. How are you today?
Oh, very good. Very good. It's a beautiful Sunday morning down here in Australia.
It's kind of amazing. This is the biggest time difference that we've had so far with one of our interviews. I hope you're wide awake.
I'm wide awake, yes.
All right. We may not be, but we'll try.
Yeah, we're going to sleep now.
So you were one of the first people that reported on Russian interference in the 2016 U.S. election. And some people believe that whole story about Russian interference has been debunked. What do you think now? It's like 5 years later.
Well, I mean, it definitely did happen, and we could see it happening sort of across the social media and media channels at the time. And you could see it with the unusual activity that was occurring, voices that were sort of wading into the debate about politics in the U.S. and sort of much more extreme voices coming in, which unfortunately we've become accustomed to in politics and democracies. But I think for the people that say that it didn't happen, I always go back to this sort of summary of how the internet works, which is even when the facts are agreed, the meaning can be reverse engineered. And I think that you see some of that around the Russian interference topic. So if you go to countries in Europe on Russia's periphery or in Central Europe and ask about Russian interference in their politics, it's a known phenomenon. It's a known tactic. It's a hybrid war, it's called a gray zone tactics. So the fact that it happened in the U.S. is sort of, it's unremarkable. I mean, as we're communicating across the internet, or, thousands of miles away today, they were doing between Russia and the United States in the 2016 election. It's what the internet allows. It's one of the downsides to all the connectivity that we have.
And, some people say, well, we do it too. The U.S. does it too. And that's really true, right?
Well, historically, during the Cold War, the U.S. definitely pushed back in the area of political warfare. So they would push the Western voices, Western worldviews. They made those available to populations behind the Iron Curtain. They would confront the Soviet worldview, Soviet propaganda, Soviet arguments that are made in public spheres all the time. The problem is that after the Cold War ended, that sort of dried up. There was no need for it. And it's not very clear that since then there's been any really coordinated response from the West in this way. There's quite a bit of confusion and inertia in this area, even at this stage. And I think that that's something that it's much easier to pick apart something than to bring something together. So I think when people make the argument that the U.S. Does the same, I don't buy it in that way. Obviously, the West has a lot of influence. Obviously, there's a lot of soft power through Western culture, Western pop culture. The voices that we have within our political sphere. But it's not the same as a coordinated effort to try to confront the influence operations that are being undertaken by the Kremlin.
Is it just the Kremlin? People talk about China doing this sort of thing, or Iraq, or some other state.
Well, that's right. So China definitely has a very extensive strategy around this, around shaping global perceptions of China from across the world. So they don't use a lot of the same tactics that the Kremlin has sort of developed and fine-tuned, but China is known for creating networks of media, local media, and Chinese language media in countries around the world, so that when they want to get a message out about China's rise, and they're very focused on this notion of projecting China's rise as a good thing for the world, as a historical inevitability, as a righteous sort of return of a society that was put down by Western imperial powers. These are all themes that they hit over and over again, including through their space program. They want to show that China is this capable, modern, technologically advanced nation. So they do this. The Iranians, obviously, they do this as well with their influence operations and their international sort of information assaults on various countries. And sometimes they do it in conjunction with Russia and China if it's a shared view. And that's often a sort of anti-Western theme about something that's happening in international events. And at other times, it's much more targeted for a particular region or particular country.
Well, the United States does have a history of interference, particularly the CIA, back in the post-World War II era. A lot of very, forceful incursions on the electoral process in many countries. One that stands out was Chile, where they definitely engineered the overthrow of a democratically elected president and replaced him with a dictator. And I wonder if the perception of our involvement in other people's politics is more due to it's not as obvious, perhaps, because they've learned how to conceal themselves better and how to use cutouts, other people to do their bidding.
Well, I mean, that's definitely true. During the Cold War, the U.S. had a record, a very clear record of interference in other nations to support the Western governments and Western political forces, starting in Italy in 1948, Chile in 1973, without a doubt. But I think you hit on something that's very true for the time that we're living in now, which is a lot of this technology has been created in the West, but the understanding of the ability to really exploit it to try to influence situations has been really it's been developed and perfected by countries and cultures outside of the West. So, when you and I talk online, we're using words and we're expressing our ideas. And it's this notion that, well, we're going to sort of get to this consensus, or we're going to discover what we share in common or what we disagree with. But it's sort of this idea that our words are used as, where we share our ideas in this sort of open environment. I think in an authoritarian nation, it's much more common to look at words as just one more tool that can be used to achieve a particular political goal. And so it's almost like a no-brainer for a nation like China or Russia to use information as a, you know, as a tool, for this particular, you know, to achieve this particular end. And that, that is something that I think is going to take, it's taking a real, there's a real learning curve going on in Western societies about this sort of thing, because how do we manage to have this open debate, and particularly in democracies where we rely on this open exchange of ideas, but also inoculating ourselves from the kind of outside voices that can be used to work, you know, to try to radicalize and polarize the debate. And obviously in democracies today, there's enough natural division that we don't need other voices outside making it worse. So yeah, there's a real learning curve going on there. And and that's not to say that what happened during the Cold War didn't happen. One of the most interesting elements I think that we see these days is, if you look back historically, so much of the Cold War hinged on the ability to project power and hard power. So thankfully, a lot of this hardware was never used. But if you remember, it was all about how many tanks, how many planes, how big were air forces, how many nuclear weapons. The time that we're living in now seems to be not as much about hard power, but about this sort of information power. How do you skillfully use information to try to shift the public's perceptions, including the global public, in the direction that suits your nation's narrative? I think that, you know, to me, it's fascinating because the technology is developed in the West, but it seems like the West is, the political leadership in the West are some of the least expert in using this technology to promote the ideals of democracy and rule of law and, you know, freedom from corruption. It's kind of stunning. Instead, it's all the worst elements that seem to be, most easily amplified on these platforms.
I mean, I think that part of it is just kind of a growing understanding among some of those worst elements that, that they could manipulate or influence the way that people think. And I guess one question is, to what extent are they really successful at doing that? I mean, like, you had Russian, we know that Russians were putting posts on platforms like Facebook. Did those really have as much influence over the election as some people think? I mean, were they really driving a lot of votes to Trump, or were they just confirming the biases of people who sort of already agreed with what they were seeing?
Well, I mean, that is a good question. I think that in the final analysis, it was probably more than just these posts from the Internet Research Agency in St. Petersburg. I mean, what I find interesting working in the news is there were a lot of efforts that were happening at the same time through the 2016 campaign, and that turned on and off since then. But something about the way that the 2016 campaign occurred, once Trump won, the media really seized on the Internet Research Agency, which was known before 2016 as this sort of magic silver bullet that was the cause of everything. And I think that it's sort of locked onto this particular story. And I think that there's quite a bit more to it than that, including, of course, the underlying politics. I mean, Trump, some of what Trump voiced is what people felt as this anxiety, or, you know, there after, was it two, three decades of deregulation and free market economics, you have a lot of people that were left behind. So it was just a matter of getting to these people and getting a voice in front of them to say, globalization has been a ripoff for you. I'm going to stand up for the nation, and I'm going to push back on free trade. And people rallied to that. The racist elements to it as well. You don't recognize your country anymore because people look different than they looked 50 years ago. People glommed onto that, and that you cannot blame on a foreign power. I mean, there is definitely organic politics underneath or alongside what was manipulated in 2016, but disentangling the two can be very hard. So it's an area that even now, what are we, 5 years after the fact, that particular moment, I think, is a very interesting time to look at, because it really was, as I've heard other people say, it's kind of the moment when the 21st century began. It's something that was so unprecedented. So we had all this technology, we had all these politics, but for them to come together in this way, where people were saying, look, we can use this technology on these platforms to achieve these new, or to assist in achieving these new goals and to shift these perceptions in this way. That was a really new sort of future shock moment. And the other big, world-changing event of the 21st century, of course, would be the pandemic, I would think. But those two, 2016 and then the pandemic, are these two sort of really earth-shattering events that we're living through, and we're still living through the consequences of them today.
Yeah, this domestic messaging from the, especially from the far right, has been going on for a while. So this was really just kind of an escalation. And one thing that I was always aware of, well, I wasn't always aware of it, but I became aware of it, was that some of this was really stealth. I mean, there were networks of people pumping out emails to people who they thought could be influenced. And this was particularly active within the Republican Party. And if you had a crazy uncle, maybe he would forward you one of those emails and you'd get a little glimpse at it. But there was no way to really see that if you were trying to do an analysis of the public internet. It was happening more stealth. And, you know, same thing, you've got private groups on platforms like Facebook. So there's a lot of stuff that could be going on that you can't really see, and you can't even really assess how much of it there is.
Oh, definitely. I mean, isn't that the nature of the internet, where you have, you know, 50 years ago, so much of this was centralized. You could look somewhere and say, this is what's happening in the media, because we can see our, you know, limited number of media outlets are saying this. So you could sort of see it. You could sort of track. But these days, you know, the decentralized nature of the internet, which I guess has been an ideal among some in the technology world, has given us this world where we can't track what's going on around us. And this isn't just true with things like, you know, political information or political misinformation, but it's also true with, say, cryptocurrency. And this is an area that I've been looking at, but seeing these transactions that are going across borders, it's no longer as simple as just asking somebody to disclose that they've received $10,000. You don't know where this money or this wealth is shifting to and from. So, I mean, it's something that I marvel at, because I'm old enough to remember that when you know, years ago, when we looked to the future, it was always the sort of, everything was orderly and idealized and clean. And I mean, that was the notion of the future that was sold to the public. And now that we're here, it's a little bit more just people walking around trying to figure out what exactly is going on. If why is this person suddenly, you know, on my screen, making this claim that I'm going to spend 20 minutes trying to debunk, and then, you know, it's going to alter the news cycle for the next 24 hours. I mean, it's just sort of this, you know, it's allowed for this kind of anarchy that we're seeing that's really challenging the system and challenging the fundamental basis of the political system that we all believe in. So, yeah, it's quite a moment.
You mentioned cryptocurrency, and it's the preferred money or exchange for activity on the internet by the Russian and Chinese hacker groups that have been doing a lot of damage to the United States and other Western democracies, either the government or corporations, by ransomware attacks. And these things first surfaced back during the 2016 elections, and the Russians were blamed for a lot of this interference. And I see that the 2016 election seemed like that was like a weapons test for what's going to be happening in future elections and future incursions into the Western governments by both the Russians and the Chinese.
Yeah, I do wonder, if some of the tactics that we saw in 2016 were happening again today, would they be successful? I do think that since then there's sprung up this sort of community of people that are actively watching and actively trying to report and push back on this sort of activity. And they have had some degree of support, or a decent amount of support, from the social media platforms themselves. So there are at least these lines of communication. I think that in 2016, these lines of communication didn't even exist between sort of self, selected groups of people that are looking for misinformation, or even formal groups that are looking for misinformation, and the platforms. So I don't know. I don't know if 2016 could happen again in the same way, but it's almost like it's just the new game. It's just the new, like, this has just been internalized as this is the world that we're in, where people will use, they will use information in whatever way they can to achieve the goal that they can. I mean, the one question that I have is how much, and in a domestic environment in particular, so looking at politics here in Australia, politics within the United States, how much are people plotting this? Or thinking this out as a strategy to you know, to try to flood the zone and change people's minds? Or how much are people just being trained by the platforms themselves that, you know, if you post this thing and it's a little bit extreme, it's a little bit radical, but boy, it's getting a lot of traction. Doesn't that just teach you in the feedback loop to post more in that way? So even politically, it doesn't make sense to talk in sort of centrist terms. That just makes you invisible. You want to speak in more extreme, you know, more extreme terms, more to the far right, more to the far left, so that it gets more traction. So, I mean, that's another sort of unintended consequence, I think, of the structure of this communication platforms.
Yeah, and to your question, I think it's all of the above, right? You probably have people who are planning things out, and you probably have people who are working with more randomness and sort of chaotic frenzy. And they're both having an effect. In fact, their combined effect is substantially more than the effect of either one of them would be.
Yeah. So the question is, where does it all go? I mean, I don't know. I mean, you know, how does a political system based on open debate survive a time where debate has become sort of unmanageable? It's become, you know, it's become something where it's hard to discern the logic behind what you're seeing on a day-to-day basis.
Well, there used to be a sense of authority for truth. I mean, it wasn't necessarily shared among everybody, but people had kind of a sense that there were places they could go to get authoritative or canonical information, you know. The New York Times used to be like that, and now, you know, the New York Times is much denigrated. There were a limited number of news sources, and they were all vetted, and you didn't have things that were flying so chaotically around the infosphere, because the infosphere was a more limited space. So I guess the question now is, could we ever again put this genie back in the bottle and have again some sense of an authority for truth? And I kind of think not exactly, you know. I mean, we kind of have to think about that being the problem, but I'm not sure that there's, it's like a wicked problem, one that doesn't really have a clear solution.
Yeah, and I think that whatever the solution is, it's not going to be to just roll back the clock to how it was in the past. Because, I mean, the one, and I'd be curious what your views are of this, but if you could go back to that time, wasn't the complaint when there was centralized media and there was this respect for this authoritative truth that the media was always leaving out something, like that there was this sort of overly pat view of the world that was being presented by media, but it was conveniently chopping out stuff, you know, elements or angles that were true, but that just weren't being covered because of the scarcity of the media.
I mean, if you realize that media is influence, then you try to use it to effectively influence things. And if the media is controlled by a particular ideology or a particular sort of worldview, say a capitalist worldview, then there's going to be selection, conscious and unconscious, of what's presented, and there's going to be some influence. And kind of what's happened now, though, is that there is no kind of respect for any kind of media. Everybody sort of takes for granted the fact, or understands the fact, that everything that people are writing, or the pictures that they're posting, even the videos they're posting, they're not necessarily a representation of some absolute reality. They're all just people express. It's all opinion, you know. And the more we start to think things are all opinion, the more that they seem to become all opinion. And you know, I realize now that another influence on that too is the fact that news organizations used to be like lost leaders. They didn't really try to make a profit, and now they try really hard to be profitable, mm-hmm. and they focus not on accuracy but on what sells, basically. So they're constantly trying to sell attention, and this potentially corrupts any sense of presenting an absolute truth or a correct sense of reality. And people have come to believe that nobody really sees clearly what's real, so they don't really trust anybody's perception and anybody's representation of their perception in media. It's a big problem.
Well, it is. As though, I mean, it seems like there's no central. I mean, I guess if you go back, wasn't the hope of the internet in the early days, people on the internet, that they would be able to get their voices in and they'd be able to not necessarily challenge the official accounts, but there was the freedom of publishing and of expression in a time when the major media still dominated. So you could say these wild things, but at the end of the day, people were still talking about what the New York Times was reporting or Wall Street Journal.
Well, I can tell you what we were saying around, this was around 2000 when blogs were starting to be a thing. And sort of the primary activity of people online who were not necessarily news professionals, they would blog. So you had blogs all over the place. And we would say that a bunch of bloggers might show up at an event and blog their perspectives of it. And by reading the different perspectives, that you could sort of synthesize a much clearer picture of the event. That was, I mean, we were so naive, but that's kind of what we believed. We believed that it would, that bringing more voices into the mix would result in a better sense of what's real. And it never occurred to us that bringing more voices into the mix would just create chaos and confusion about what's real. But that's kind of what we have.
But was that true at the time that it actually did give a better perspective, because there was still a limited number of people that were blogging? So that was still a somewhat discrete community. It wasn't just a mass of people. It was, you know, self-selected group that was moved into this area, and that they were presumably interested enough, engaged enough, articulate enough to make good points that allowed you to better discover the truth. And then, I mean, the question I ask myself is it just a scale issue? Like, that would have been true, say, what year were that? Mid-90s are you talking about at that time?
Well, the blogging really started coming into its own around 2000, but it started earlier. It started, you know, like from 95 to 2000, people were starting to get online and have a voice, and you could see signs of what would later emerge as social media.
So that is a compliment to the established media. Like, maybe it did have some utility or some value in that way, is the way you're describing it. But then, like, to me, the scale issues, then when everybody's online and everybody's basically a de facto self-made media source, like, depending on what people are posting on social media. But, you know, we see in the news when an incident happens and somebody's nearby and they're posting it on social media, and it's credible, we have every reason to believe, and we verify it, then that gets ingested into the media cycle itself. So to a certain degree, everybody is de facto participating in the media.
Well, early in the early days of the internet, the first people who were online were relatively civil, geeky people who were were, you know, not going to try to screw anybody. They were going to be really pretty honest and civil, and they'd really want to kind of do the right thing. And I remember people saying back then, you know, arguing against mainstreaming, saying, we don't want everybody, this is our internet, we don't want a bunch more people in here because they'll just screw it up. And then there were people, and I may have been one of them, who said, oh, no, no, it'll be great. We can bring everybody online and things will be so much better. It'll be just spreading of the idea of civility. Everybody will pick that up from us. Well, I mean, that's not what happened, right? Mm-hmm. You have people who will abuse things and corrupt things, and they start showing up when you're mainstreaming. And then you also have this potential for real chaos, which is kind of, you know, where we've landed lately, is that there's quite a bit of chaos because you have so many voices in the mix, and nobody knows which voice to believe anymore. And that's also actually a problem of democracy. If I mean, in a pure sense of democracy, everybody should have a voice, but if everybody has a voice, who can you listen to?
Lately watching the interplay between social media and politics, I wonder more and more, and this goes to the point of whatever the solution is, it's not going to look like the past, but I mean, is it possible that we have to develop a sort of a skepticism for everything we see online until we get a secondary or, you know, a third, you know, affirmation that this is true. So you might read this article or you might see this post, but like, do we somehow try to put distance between ourselves and the content and say, we're not totally certain that this is worth responding to or worth considering until we get more confirmation from alternate, you know, from secondary and third sources. Like, I mean, it seems sort of going back to front, but I think part of the issue with the social media world is that you see something and it's visceral. It's in your disembodied mind. It's overwhelming your mind. And then there's the immediate desire to respond to it. And there's not this sort of social construct around saying, wait a minute, if I lash out, if I just react to this, that would look bad. As it would in the physical world, where if you're standing with a group of people and somebody's saying something controversial, you might not have the desire to immediately launch back with some sort of fiery counter argument. You might say, well, I'm just going to, you know, I don't agree with them, but I'm just going to let it go. So it's like this, you know, there's the social element, I think, of social media is actually almost a problem for democracy, because we have to be able to let our cool minds thrive. So not this sort of hot button response to something, but this more dispassionate, sort of more reason based, more consensus based. I mean, that's what we need, is some sort of general air of consensus that I think is starting to just crumble because of the way that the public is embracing social media.
Well, the fact that what we're doing right now was not possible back in the pre-internet era. We're recording a podcast. You know, we're in Texas, you're in Australia, and it's so easy to do that. I mean, it's not expensive like it used to be. When I started out in radio journalism, it was impossible for anyone other than a, you know, very rich person to have their own media outlet. You know, it was expensive, but the tools of what we're doing now are available at any online and at any store that sells computers and recording equipment. So it's a matter of, it's really easy to be a media figure, but it's not so easy to be a good one. But there's plenty out there. I remember from my first journalism class, we were assigned, talking about, you know, the truth in media. We were assigned our first big assignment was to go to the library and read the Hearst newspapers from back in the 20s, 30s, 40s, and that was a where a yellow journalism came from. They were very misleading on just about any subject, and that was a real eye-opener. We didn't think that was possible in this United States of America, but it was one of the most powerful media operations out there. So the fact that it's so easy to be a media operation now, do you see that as being a bad thing or a good thing?
Well, I mean, I think on the, the first take would be, it's probably a good thing, but our society and our political societies, especially in democracies, have to learn to adjust to this. There has to be this ability to be able to organize this information in our minds. Like I am a big believer that whatever the solution, the lasting solution, a lot of it has to happen, I think, in the political awareness of the public, rather than just assuming that we can just engineer, like that more engineering of the technology is going to help. I think that, no, that's probably not the answer. At this point, we need to start thinking about how do we start to not just educate ourselves, but how do we gird ourselves for this environment where we can get so much contradictory information, so much information that's telling us to disbelieve or leading us to disbelieve in things that we should, that we do need to believe in, that's going to be the real challenge. And it's funny. I mean, you talk about the Hearst papers and that sort of yellow journalism. So there was, in the history of democracy, there were periods where there were sort of Wild West moments in media, and we somehow, there were movements to reform them too. So maybe that's what we'll see in open democracies, where we understand the threat or the challenge that this technology poses, and that there's also resolve that people in the public decides, look, we don't want to live in this environment of this constant sort of information chaos before us. It's not good for our democracy, but it also doesn't represent well, what the society wants. I mean, and we see this all the time now around the issue of COVID. There are people that genuinely don't believe that the medical science, has the right answers, but them spreading their views is actually becoming a public health risk to everyone else. So we have to confront these sort of heavy sort of public policy moral issues about who has access to this technology to spread these views and are these, what is legitimate to be pushing? And I think that is one of the confusions with social media, John, as you sort of alluded to, is that everything kind of becomes equal. So you can have, you can have an epidemiologist that has spent their career studying this, and they're coming up against, a 20-year-old that has a different idea, and that 20-year-old might have more information firepower, and they can spread their idea further, saying that vaccines don't work, or there's some hidden agenda with vaccines. That is a problem. I mean, that really is. But I think that, if there's a shared desire to overcome this problem, then society can get past it. But for me, it's, the human mind desires and requires a certain amount of order in their environment. And if they don't have that over time, I think that's where we start to have a real problem, because then it just becomes this free for all. So, I mean, it is interesting watching what's happening in the US with regards to this, because it does seem like there's a real sort of cultural clash going on between the political parties and the use of information. So, that's an area to watch. And if one is decisively, beaten by the other, that's going to tell us a lot about the future direction of American democracy, at least.
There are people who really want to have a media police, a police force to go out and shut down media that either they don't agree with or they think is being dishonest. And a lot of these same people are the people that are being dishonest in the media, especially in this country. So how do you balance that? I mean, sure, it would be nice to have a little quality control, but it kind of depends on who's doing the controlling.
Yeah, no, it's an issue. I mean, I think what is important is that there's some sort of respect for truth. And I think that is eroded over time. But one of the things in the sort of the original DNA of the of the early promoters of the internet. So this is going back again to, we're talking about the bloggers, is there's this notion of freedom of speech as an absolute freedom. And I think whenever I hear the word freedom invoked, my first question is freedom from what and freedom to do what? And that is often never answered. So some of the worst, in my opinion, some of the worst and most damaging characters online that we've seen over the past 5, 6 years have been the ones who have called for this absolute, freedom of speech. And often what in practice it is their freedom to say whatever they want to say, no matter how unrelated to the truth it is, or to the facts, I should say, that it is. And you see that a lot. So I want to defame, I want to tear apart the reputation of a legitimate politician. Well, I don't have the basis, in fact, to do that, but it's my freedom to do that. So you see that. I mean, we saw that in 2016 and we still see that. I remember at one point Donald Trump saying, what about my freedom of speech? So that he had the freedom to be on social media to scapegoat various ethnic populations and the like. I mean, is that freedom? People need to be able to ask this question. Is that freedom or is that tyranny? Because,
I was just gonna say, we have a very interesting problem in the U.S. of having a large number of people, not a majority, but a large enough number of people who are somewhat amplified and loud, who are trying to hold in their head at the same time the idea of freedom and the idea of authoritarianism, and trying to serve kind of both. And freedom to them is like their freedom. It's not shared freedom. Mm-hmm. But you can't really have a free society if everybody takes absolute freedom to do whatever the hell they want to do. It's like a shared freedom thing. And it's sort of like, I mean, this plays out in public health right now. People say, well, we should have the right to refuse to wear masks and take the vaccine. But when they do that, they're harming other people. So should they have that right? Well, probably not. And that's, a bit of principle of public health for forever. I mean, when I was a kid and they realized that a vaccination would prevent children from developing polio, there was no question that they were going to give every kid that vaccine. They didn't have people who, as a political point, opposed the idea of delivering the vaccine. It's kind of there's an information chaos involved here too. There's people who don't think anything of a law that requires them to fasten their seatbelt, but they absolutely don't want a law that requires them to wear a mask.
Yeah, no, it's a real, I mean, I do think that this notion of, it's become very damaging, this notion of, this absolutism about freedom. And it's also, when you look at it, in my opinion, it's a sort of a libertarian freedom, which is all about the individual. But I think what would save democracy is this notion of shared freedom, which I think if you go back a few decades and even, of course, back to the Cold War and even probably to the early Cold War, there was a notion of shared freedom. I mean, you had these experiences of the public that had lived through the Depression, had fought World War II. So these huge collective experiences. And so the notion that freedom was actually shared wasn't such a foreign idea. Somehow freedom has become very atomized and very confused with the sort of consumer freedom and consumer choice of like my preference, but there's not this idea of this kind of shared freedom. And I think that, once we get the debate in that direction, including around the use of the internet and in a political dimension, I think that you can have a much more productive debate, because it doesn't mean that people aren't, it doesn't mean that people cannot dissent or cannot disagree, but this notion that I'm going to hoist the flag of freedom and then work as like a wrecking ball to tear down any shared trust in facts, that's the problem that we see. And in my opinion, you see online consistently some of the same voices that will get that will insert themselves into debates to constantly seed doubt and distrust, all under the banner of freedom, freedom. And culturally, people in democracies are raised to embrace the notion of liberty and freedom. So it's very hard. It's not just hard, but it creates a kind of blindness. I mean, this person's telling me freedom, but but you know, the end result is a sort of chaos, but I'm not going to say anything against the notion of freedom or liberty. So it's sort of this paralysis. So there's got to be this more advanced notion of, well, freedom from what and freedom to do what. People need to be able to think in those terms. And I think that has been because of the drift of democracies in the past 30 years, that's become sort of a lost art. So if people can talk about collective freedoms, that it becomes different again. And it becomes more, you know, there's more possibility for progress and consensus.
So the life of and mind of everyone, it's all sort of rolled over into social media, and we have a few powerful social media platforms. You know, you've got Twitter and TikTok and YouTube, but then there's Facebook, and Facebook is sort of like, I think everybody sort of acknowledges that Facebook is sort of like the biggest and most influential of those platforms. And really Facebook works as well as it does because of the network effect it's had. There was so much adoption. They've got so many people into Facebook now that it creates the network effect of like everybody needs to be there because everybody else is there. But this is also kind of a monopoly move on Facebook's part. I mean, I don't know that they intended to build this thing, but it certainly evolved into something that feels like a monopoly. And there's a question about whether that should be broken up in some way. I just wonder how, I mean, does that need to happen? How would you do that? How would you make it so that Facebook is not so much a monopoly, but can still function because its network effect is a big component of its value?
Well, history offers examples in what was done with monopolies in the past. So railroads and telephone companies and the like. And I think, I mean, the historical example is that the government and the public is sort of happy to stand back and allow this technology to evolve and to innovate. And then once it becomes a clear monopoly and the public is suffering, then they want the government to step in and break it up. So I don't know. I mean, with Facebook, you know, I don't know, would you create regional Facebooks, or more likely, would you take certain elements and force them to divest, say, WhatsApp from Facebook because that's too much concentration of power there. Certain, you know, marketing, advertising capabilities of Facebook would be broken off again so that you didn't have that sort of soup to nuts control of the advertising environment. Just recently here in Australia, they have passed their media bargaining code, which actually compels the major platforms to negotiate with the media companies to reimburse the media companies for the content that's being used on the social media platforms. But one of the most interesting things that came out of that was a very detailed analysis of this advertising, the sort of captured advertising ecosystem that companies like Facebook and Google in particular have developed. And I think once you dig into that, that's where you could see some sort of effective reform, because you'd be able to see where you could split off parts of the company to make it something that was less monopolistic. Because, I mean, the issue with the monopoly with the social media companies is so great that, in my opinion, it's spilled into even the area of the people that are trying to push back on the bad information. They're reliant on what information that these companies will provide them to use as source material, which to me is completely circular. And there's no, we talk about getting to the truth. How can you ever get to the truth of the matter of something that's happening on the social media platforms if you rely only on the information that the platforms will give you? So it is, I mean, I think that there is a legitimate monopoly case about the social media platforms, or Facebook in particular, but it's a matter of, you know, of some smart people really looking at this and pulling it apart. And, you know, to give credit where it's due, the Australian government has done a lot of work in this to try to figure out how are these advertising ecosystems developed sort of behind the scenes in a way that the public doesn't even realize that they're a captive audience.
So Cory Doctorow talks about adversarial interoperability as a way to address this sort of monopoly situation. But I don't know how clear it is how that would actually work. I mean, adversarial interoperability is basically like other people building products and services being able to plug into a company like Facebook and use Facebook's service without necessarily having Facebook's permission to do that. And a big piece of Facebook's value is the data that they hold on everybody, and the fact that people use their platform, and it, in a sense, it's like they go to their platform as if they're going into a space of some kind, you know? So if you could like draw this out, if you could have other systems that could connect to Facebook and leverage the same data, if Facebook was like required to share their data in some way, that might be one way to address it. But I don't know what the plan, you know, I can't imagine what that plan would look like. Illegally, you know.
No, it would take some I mean, I think that there there are good minds working at this, but yeah, there's got to be something about the, you know, who has access to the information. I mean, I would think that, again, this is going back to this area of countering disinformation, but you know, if it's in the public's interest to know what's happening on the platforms, especially if there's some sort of manipulative information at work, there's got to be a way to access that in a without the filter of a company's media relations department overseeing it. There's got to be a way to have a direct access into that. And I mean, you know, if they could solve that problem, that might also solve problems around advertising and the like, where there is an independent view into this platform that is not, you know, that's not at the mercy of the commercial interests of the platform. I mean, but the thing is, I mean, what's interesting, again, I mean, there's a historical precedent. This technology is developed, and it's developed far faster than the government can possibly understand or regulate it. So it's a matter of the government playing catch up and then, you know, figuring out how to best go about disentangling this in the interest of the public. So, I mean, I think it can be done, but I do think that there is that, you know, it's that traditional lag, and it's in the tradition of the sort of capitalist system that you allow the innovation to occur, and then you try to fix it and make it fair, you know, later on. So I mean, hopefully we're in that phase. I mean, yeah, hopefully that's the phase that we'll see next.
Well, we've seen plenty of efforts at getting away from Facebook. I've lost track of the number of people who said, I'm getting off of Facebook, I just can't stand it anymore, it's bumming me out. And then they're back in a couple of weeks because they've gone to these other companies that have been trying to be the next Facebook, and they just don't have the finances, basically, or the number of users to really make a go of it. And so Facebook continues along merrily. And if someone does have a good grasp on doing a better thing than Facebook is doing, they buy them up. And that's what we've seen. Endlessly, they buy up Instagram or whatever comes up. And so it's very hard to have an alternative to any of these big technological giants. Apple, they do the same thing. You do a good high-tech product, Apple buys it up, and it's suddenly an Apple product. So how do we cope with that?
I mean, there's no simple solution. I mean, I think there has to be the public will to want to do this, but it seems to me that the stakes are rising even higher because now, as you know, Facebook is promoting its cryptocurrency, which is now called Diem. I think it was initially called Libra. But one of the arguments that's being made about Facebook for this currency is that this is an answer to what the Chinese government is promoting with their yuan, which is their digital, their sort of state-based cryptocurrency. And so because of the scale and the network effect of Facebook, they're saying, look, if this is supported, then this is going to give us something to compete against this emerging currency that China could, you know, if it's successful, I mean, they've already launched it, but if it's successful and spread, it will become this sort of web of influence for trade for China. So it's moved out of the realm just of information and content and, you know, the material that people use to inform their lives and entertain themselves with into the world of commerce. So, I mean, my view is if, you know, if there's an argument for supporting Facebook's cryptocurrency, it's got to be in the public's interest. So there's got to be more. I mean, the public has to have more of a voice. I mean, again, this becomes all very, because of the engineering, it becomes very complicated very quickly. So then I think the human mind looks for something to sum it up. And I keep on going back to this phrase from Cicero, you know, the Roman statesman, saying freedom is participation in power. And so we've got a society where there's a lot of people that don't have this participation in power for all these reasons. We need to ensure that as we move forward, you know, even in regulation of tech platforms, that there is a, you know, that the freedom is something that the public has. It's not just in the hands of people that are making these sort of unilateral decisions in California and the rest of the world has to follow along with. So, and hopefully, you know, hopefully we're in a phase where that is something that people can embrace and not just support this notion of freedom that is, you know, more selfish and sort of libertarian in nature.
How do you think about identity politics and all of this?
Well, it's very interesting. I mean, I think that from my understanding and my reading, identity politics was something that the world was already drifting in this direction years ago. So just recently I rewatched Do the Right Thing by Spike Lee. 1989. So that's right before the end of the Cold War. And it's very much, I mean, to watch it, it's almost like a movie from today. I mean, it has elements in it that are like things that you see with the Black Lives Matter movement. And the key part of it is that in the setting of the movie, there's an Italian pizzeria in a black part of town in New York. And some of the local patrons, all the patrons are black. Some of the local patrons take exception to this wall of fame that shows only Italians and, you know, Italian Americans and no blacks. And that really is sort of to the a situation that you could see today where you want, it's one thing to have the power inscribed, you know, written into law, but it's another to have the power of identity, to be participating in that identity. I think that the internet has completely supercharged this debate. And I think it's gone from this world where we used to think in terms, you know, when we talk about freedom, it was my rights, my access to my share of prosperity or my access to, you know, my sense of release from these constraints, whatever, to this notion of freedom where it is my, you know, my freedom is my ability to see myself represented and to have, you know, to see a manifestation of myself in this debate or in this topic. I heard an interesting analysis about social media saying that one of the ways to describe social media is a competition of identities. So something happens and then the relevant identity, people from that identify with a particular element of this debate stand up and make themselves known and make their view known. And so there is, and require, request, or demand acknowledgement of their identity. I mean, I think that it is, you know, it's something that's happened with globalization, with the internet, and with social media in particular, but it's really starting to become a defining issue of how to navigate democracy. And I think, for me, I think that maybe a possible solution is, can we develop shared identities that people can participate in that respect all the differences of different peoples, different, you know, different backgrounds, different ways that they identify, but is also somehow at the same time unifying? I mean, is that possible? So it's not just one identity, but it's, you know, different identities layered upon each other.
You can be tribal without being a warrior, right?
Yeah.
You don't have to fight.
Yeah. I mean, because we would have had all these different identities in previous times, but the information, I mean, going back to this idea of the previous information world, it didn't, I mean, and obviously there was institutional racism that accounted for a lot of this, but the actual nature of the communications, because they were held in the hands of the few, it couldn't accommodate or didn't accommodate so many, you know, so much of the element of identity. So, I mean, it is interesting to look at the civil rights era through the prism of the media of that time. So it was, you know, talking about identity, it was a much more simplified discussion, I think, because there were limits on how much identity could be accommodated by the technology, by the communications technology of the time.
What do you think about critical race theory?
My understanding of it is that, so it's a real thing. It was taught in some universities, but it's been seized on and blown up into this massive, it's basically a meme that has been embraced by a lot of the right. So, but it has a core of truth in it. So, I mean, and I make the analogy to the Antifa, which happened a couple of years ago. So Antifa is a real group, very small group on the fringes. And I actually conferred with a friend that tracks these groups as part of his work in the United States, asking about Antifa. And he said, yes, it's real, but it's very small, located in a couple, you know, discrete communities where they're active. But at a certain time, if you logged on, you were seeing stories about Antifa in buses, Antifa, you know, taking, you know, commercial charter jets around the country to disrupt events. And what was very interesting about that is there were more reports of this from small towns in the U.S. than from big towns. So there was this fear of this Antifa boogeyman. I think with critical race theory, it's somewhat similar. So there, it does exist, but it does not exist at nearly the scale that people on the right side of the political spectrum would tell you that it exists. So it's sort of this, you know, blown up, you know, functionally a straw man that is, you know, being held up saying, no, we reject this. And this again is the way that on social media, you can spin this other reality, and it's enough to change the actual, you know, physical reality in front of us.
I hate to say this, but we have reached the end of the hour. And I can think of so much more that we could talk about. So hopefully you can come back sometime and we can talk some more. I meant to ask you more about Australia, but I guess we'll do that next time.
Yeah, we want to hear about your news. And we will be promoting our own cryptocurrency, Plutopia Bucks. And we'll be sure and send you some. It's not worth anything, but if you ever need toilet paper, there you go.
I'll be an early adopter.
Well, thanks so much. Look forward to talking again sometime.
Yeah, thank you, John. Thank you very much.
You can follow the Plutopia News Network at plutopia.io. On Facebook, go to @PlutopiaNews. On Twitter, it's @Plutopia. With John Lepkoski, I'm Scoop Sweeney. This is the Plutopia News Network, 20 minutes into the future.